Welcome to the Citizen Bitcoin Podcast. I'm Brady, and I'm sharing my journey learning Bitcoin, hoping it makes yours a bit easier. So what's up out there, Bitcoiners? Hope you all are doing well. It's another week here at the dawn of the Bitcoin Renaissance. Thanks for being here with me today, and I've got a great one with Corey Clipston for you. He's the founder of Give Bitcoin. I'm excited to share this conversation with you and also excited to be repping Give Bitcoin. As you may have seen already on Twitter, Give Bitcoin is the first official sponsor of the pod. So big thanks to Corey for supporting my work and Give Bitcoin team for investing in Bitcoin education in general. So Give Bitcoin is creating a clever new way to turn your pre-coiner friends and family into well-educated hodlers. You can gift them time-locked Bitcoin. It's time-locked for at least a year, up to 5 years. And your hodler-to-be friend or family member will receive, month by month for that first year, a world-class Bitcoin education. It is such a great idea. So check this out. This past weekend, I was talking to my dad, and I told him about this sponsorship and Give Bitcoin. And that conversation ended with him asking me for some time-locked Bitcoin and the Give Bitcoin education program for Christmas. I've been shilling him super hard for a couple of years. And so the fact that the Give Bitcoin idea finally made him comfortable enough to take the plunge says a ton. I'll be giving him some Bitcoin via Give Bitcoin soon, and I'll keep you all updated on how it's going for him. So Give Bitcoin has solved that pre-coiner to Bitcoiner equation. It's give plus time lock plus educate equals Bitcoiner. So check out Give Bitcoin right now. The beta was officially launched today at beta.givebitcoin.io. Okay, we'll get into all the details and context with Corey in this conversation. So let's just jump right into it. Here we go. Let's go. Yeah, so I am super excited to welcome Corey Clipston to the Citizen Bitcoin Podcast. Corey, how's it going, man?
Man, I'm excited to be here. I was trying to earn my citizenship.
You're a sovereign citizen of Bitcoin, and you want to help a lot of people become sovereign citizens of Bitcoin. So I'm here for that, man.
Yeah, no, for sure. Like you seem to get more of the evangelists, like the hardcore evangelists, on more frequently than anybody else. And like we literally built this product for them. So I'm just glad to be in good company.
Yeah, this is going to be a great tool for the evangelists among us. Before we get too much farther, I got to say a big thanks to you and Give Bitcoin for being the first sponsor of this podcast. Our mutual like dedication to helping people understand what's happening here and helping them become, like we said, good citizens of Bitcoin in this Bitcoin future we're building, I think makes us the perfect partnership. So I'm really happy, man.
Yeah, listen, man, it's important to be in these things early because sometimes they get to be a big deal. And I think your trajectory is really good. And, you know, I think this is kind of like getting into Bitcoin in like 2011 or something.
Yeah, absolutely, man. I agree completely. I think it's gonna get pretty crazy over these next few years. It's already been crazy.
We're talking about your podcast, right?
Yeah, well, and just Bitcoin in general. But yeah, the podcast too. I mean, it's on a similar trajectory, I guess. We're all sort of on the Bitcoin rocket ship at this point. Yeah. But
well, now Plan B is gonna ask if the Brady podcast and Bitcoin actually have co-integration with their high R squared.
So far we're pretty well co-integrated. We're gonna be able to see after the halving if the Citizen Bitcoin podcast isn't over 55,000 downloads per episode by next Christmas, then we'll know that the model is broken.
Awesome. Well played.
Yeah, so okay, let's talk about Give Bitcoin. Let's start with the basics, and then we can dive into some context and details behind the company. All right, so let's say you're sharing an Uber with a Bitcoiner. What's the Give Bitcoin pitch to them?
Yeah, sure. So basically we say give plus time lock plus educate equals Bitcoiner. And basically we've created a product that is intended to be the safest and easiest way to onboard a new coiner. And then if you sort of unpack that, basically what we set out to do is to have the highest percentage chance of getting somebody that you care about, like friend, family, colleague, you know, or maybe just somebody you met at a conference or something, to actually get them to take the red pill and start learning and start to want to learn for themselves. And then to have those good resources, you know, something authoritative, something right down the middle that's good for Bitcoin, you know, available to them and actually like spoon fed to them. And everything just came out of that, the genesis of that, or I should say the kernel of that idea. And then what do you need to build around that to make that happen?
So I definitely want to get into more of the details about the product. Got a lot of questions for you there.
Mm-hmm, for sure.
But I'd like to get some of the context about the Give Bitcoin story, the mission. Maybe some of your, even go back as far as, I know you have an extensive professional background. It's really impressive. You can go back and talk about some of that as if you think it's, you know, relevant to the Give Bitcoin story. And I'd also like to hear your Bitcoin story in general. Like, can you give us some of that background and bring us up to that Give Bitcoin, that Give Bitcoin founding moment?
Yeah, for sure. So, you know, everybody has their, like, if we all end up in Bitcoin, you know, you can point to a number of things that led you to get there. But at the end of the day, like, every human story on the globe is going to result in them becoming a Bitcoiner. So, you know, it's really just like a wealth of,
because we're talking about the largest market of any product, right?
That's right. Yeah, half of every transaction. So we're all going to use Bitcoin at some point, and you know, there's going to be some way to construct a story out of your background, and you know, all the different waves and jagged lines. You can draw a straight line through it in the end, right? So I guess like a few interesting nuggets were like, I got super into like decentralization and, you know, small scale and barbell strategies and some of that by becoming obsessed with Nassim Taleb starting in like 2002. So it's been really awesome to see him kind of get adopted as like the Bitcoin philosopher, because it's just so well aligned with all of the things that were, that
we, you were an about. Early Taleb adopter.
I was an early Taleb adopter. I wish I had Taleb coin back in 2002. I'm crushing it right now. But I did get to meet him and talk to him a little bit after he and Naval had a conversation here in LA last year. So that was like a seminal moment for me. I got to talk to actually both of them separately, which was awesome.
Wow, that's great.
That's like my thought guru and my tech guru in the same place. So yeah, I was like in the front row. There's actually like, you can see a video of me, and I just like, I'm seeing like Jesus or the Stones or something, like watching these dudes talk about nerd shit. It's awesome.
That's awesome.
So that was probably one. Another weird foundational thing that probably requires like beers or whiskey, TFTC style, I was born in the Bay Area to parents that met on Haight-Ashbury, and I was basically raised on a commune until I was like eight, where there was no money.
Whoa.
So that was like super interesting, and I don't even know how to like start to unpack that. I'll probably just like do a whole podcast on that with somebody at some point.
But
it definitely was kind of interesting, because you know, I was like a really curious kid and studied hard, and then I, you know, basically was thrust into mainstream society and public school at like, you know, in fifth grade, and you know, was kind of like Jane Goodall with the apes, trying to figure it all out. So I've always had this kind of like lens of like trying to peel back and figure out, you know, what was going on. And I think that's probably why I ended up first, you know, going to journalism school, trying to like investigate more for undergrad. So I have a broadcast degree and was like a really crappy local TV reporter when I was like 19 and 20 for a mid Missouri NBC station. And then I ended up, you know, spending a good chunk. So I was in tech initially. I went to work for Microsoft on an early interactive television product, and then decided like I wanted more money. I started to get greedy living out in New York and decided to go to business school and figure out like, how do people actually get money? Cause I had absolutely no concept of how one makes money from my childhood. So I was like, I'm going to go and learn to actually make money. Like, some people seem to have more of it. How did they get that money? So I went to University of Chicago, which is kind of like a hotbed of econ. There are some Austrians that have rolled through there and won some Nobels and stuff. So it was like exposed a little bit there. And then I did management consulting and private equity for like 7 years post business school. And it wasn't until, you know, so I was at McKinsey and Company, which is a pretty well-known consulting firm. And then I basically set up a private equity consulting firm to compete with them. Did that for a few years out of Chicago. And then in like 2009, so it was right out of the crisis. And it was funny because my formative career experience was being on the shaky foundation of the dot-com boom, right? Because I got to go to all those parties in New York and all the, you know, Silicon Alley and Jason Calacanis and all that stuff. And just like so much free money everywhere. And like, it didn't make any sense. And, you know, I spent a year running the Jaguar website for Ogilvy Interactive. It was like the year of 2000. And, you know, I probably worked like 3 hours a day or something, and was probably like maybe like in the top five performers out of a group of like 70. Oh, shit. And I was like, is this real? Like, this can't be real, right? And then so it was like almost with gratification that, like, you know, the world didn't actually, definitely had more than a little schadenfreude with the crashing of the tech bubble, because it just, like, it kind of angered me that this was all there was. And, you know, what was funny is, like, I then ran to go do something that I thought was more solid, which was like, okay, let's go to business school and let's learn how the world really works. And, you know, and then go into consulting. And, you know, now all I saw was all of the companies that were on, like, a much bigger bubble, which was the entire financial system.
Right.
Like, it wasn't just .com. It was like everything was on shaky foundation. So it was like, I just kept on, like, trying to get on firm ground and not finding it. And then it finally clicked with me, like, the only thing that you can really control is when you are, like, you know, actually in control of something small. And I think if you look at that, that's probably why I was attracted to startups in retrospect, is because you can have a lot of effect on a small business. And then as you grow it, if, you know, you can either get off the train when it becomes too big, or if you sort of maintain control and have some agency, then you can kind of stick with it. Totally. So a number of my, like, good friends from running around New York had stayed in tech that whole time and had built great companies and were, like, really well networked and had big exits and stuff like that. And so I had a good angle and a good lens and a good way to network into early stage tech. And so I went to Google first, and I worked there from 2011 to 2013, got married in late 2012, and we decided to move out to California. She wanted warm, and I really don't actually like living in SF very much. So we came to LA, which at least was like a short flight to Silicon Valley. And I had a good way to, you know, I basically met something like 1500 VCs and founders in 2 years at Google, which gave me sort of the platform to jump out and mix it up in startups. So I'm like 6.5 years now into being in startups, angel investing, advising, and operating when I see a good opportunity. And, you know, so I was a co-founder in an ad tech company from 2013 to 2015. And then this is like the second one that I've really gone hard at, as far as a startup where I'm a founder.
Super exciting, man. Really exciting. You're just the exact kind of entrepreneur that we need to get in this space. And just tons of experience, and bringing that experience to bear on this industry, is just a great story to hear. It's awesome. So let's dig into your Bitcoin education a bit, because this is, you know, Give Bitcoin is about, you know, not just about gifting someone Bitcoin. It's the larger vision is time locking that Bitcoin and then educating while that Bitcoin's time locked, so that by the time that Bitcoin becomes accessible, you've minted a new Bitcoiner, right? So tell me about your Bitcoin education.
I think I can go. Like, you want to just talk about it for like 20 minutes and I'll come back? That was perfect. So my Bitcoin education, I mean, so maybe come at it from like how I went wrong, right? So, you know, we built this product in a lot of ways to try to save Corey from 2014, because someone gave me $50 of Bitcoin in a blockchain wallet at a tech conference. And I remember the date, January 29th of 2014.
Whoa.
And I proceeded to not read the white paper, not go down the rabbit hole, and lose the key.
Okay.
You know, so that sucks. You know, what a horrible missed opportunity. You know, and I have the word Bitcoin in my Gmail from 2012. I had another chance where, you know, I was helping a buddy sell off some like angel and advisory stakes in a series LLC that included, you know, Balaji's company before it was Earn, E216. And so I actually, like, I had to put together a couple of slides about Bitcoin and and that company.
Yeah.
And this is like December of 2016, and it still didn't take. And then, like, it actually took the noise from the Ethereum run up, basically, like, only the social pressure of, or just like the social signaling of some really smart VCs that I respected, jumping into the space. And then all the noise around consensus in like May of 2017 is what finally got me. So like May 23rd, I remember it was just like one phone call that I had scheduled. And I just like heard the noise in the background and the fact that this guy had quit one of the best jobs in VC and was just like mixing it up in quote unquote crypto, is what made me start down the rabbit hole.
So what kind of resources and people did you find most helpful?
Well, I guess I did read the white paper in that first week. So that was great. Got a little bit of a foundation there. And then, you know, it's funny, like a lot of people talk about, like, what's the lens through you see this? Like, I definitely was seeing it through a tech lens. And I do a lot of work with marketplaces and platforms and SaaS companies, and in particular, like, trying to create marketplaces and platforms out of SaaS companies has been kind of a specialty.
Yeah.
And so I kind of was like super attracted to the pitch, you know, the flavor du jour in 2017 of like, you can create these, you know, Airbnb like ecosystems that have their, you know, what I would now call a friction token, but like, you know, their native token, and, you know, incentivize everybody to participate in this ecosystem. And
right.
You know, so that's like the writing that I was doing for myself at the time. I have like 60 pages of total garbage that I would burn if it wasn't on a hard drive. you know, because it's just so dumb now in retrospect. But you know, I was really convinced there, man, at the time that, you know, that there was maybe like something there. So I really, you know, I saw it very much through, you know, like, sign me up, sign summer 2017 up. Summer 2017, Corey should have been, you know, like an intern at Union Square Ventures or something, because that was, I was being spoon fed that stuff and I was like buying it. It really, you know, so I basically shitcoined, you know, with my time. You know, thankfully, like, the core of it was always Bitcoin, and Bitcoin was all that I was actually stacking. But, you know, basically wasn't until probably March of 2018, you know, the start of the winter, that I, you know, essentially accepted Bitcoin into my life and forsook all others.
Took the pledge to devote your life basically to the one, yeah, the one blockchain, I mean, the one true coin.
I mean, the funny thing, which I, you know, have talked about publicly before, is like, at that time I was already sitting in a seat as president and chief investment officer of a large-ish crypto fund that was, you know, had stakes in a bunch of ICOs, and I had done the Everpedia deal where they took the $30 million equity investment from Block One, and it helped Robot Cash, which is like a Steam PC gaming competitor, like, sort through whether they should do a utility token, and they ended up just doing like an equity deal and kind of using more of like a point system. So I was definitely like shitcoining like crazy. And then like, it just kind of like clicked for me. And I don't even remember what the nail in the coffin was for me as far as like not wanting to read another white paper ever again, other than the Bitcoin one. But, you know, it probably just came down to like understanding that security was everything, and that anything didn't, you know, basically it wasn't worth doing a public blockchain unless it was money. And until we came up with something else that was valuable enough, like, that was the argument that really resonated with me, is that it just didn't make sense to do one of these unless it was money.
Yeah. I mean, you just use a database, man, just MySQL. That's all you need.
Basically.
Yeah. For almost all of those ICOs.
Yeah. It's interesting. So
what do you,
you know, I think some of them have, probably, I was just going to say, like, some of them have a future, but the future is actually more like, you know, airline miles or something like that. Like, you certainly can have like a token in an ecosystem because that already exists, but you haven't invented anything new, and you don't need a blockchain for it. You can use one if you want to, but it's not secure. It's going to be relatively centralized compared to Bitcoin, and it's not going to drive like this insane market cap value in the long term because it's just points.
Yeah. I mean, you know, if you're getting some like American airline points, right? Like, you don't need a blockchain to prove the scarcity of that point. I mean, American Airlines is in control of that, you know, those tokens or whatever, those points. So they're just going to live on a private database is all you need. What do you think about like Liquid and RGB tokens, like on Lightning and stuff like that? Do you think that, I mean, can you imagine any use for those? I mean, obviously Liquid has, you know, an inter-exchange use case, which is pretty well proven at this point, but there's a, like, Kim.com is launching a token.
Well, I think you and I have both been privy to a lot of back and forth about that one over the last couple of days.
We were talking about it on Telegram earlier. Yeah, what's your take?
Yeah, I don't care.
I don't know.
I'm like so just heads down. I'm like, I don't have enough time to just like think about Bitcoin and what it means. And like, you know, I think you've seen some of the posts that I've been doing, trying to think through like how this all plays out in the long term. You know, because like, that is really what I'm concerned about, because, you know, I have a family and I'm an entrepreneur and I'm somewhat hinged to the success of Bitcoin. And like, I'm really thinking about like system level threats most of the day.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I'm just trying to alleviate any potential downside, like even if it's only 10% that the US government decides to outlaw Bitcoin, mm-hmm. like I want to make sure that goes from 10% down to like 0.01%.
Yeah.
So spreading mass adoption to me and getting like red pilling the most number of people, mm-hmm. You know, I actually see that as a stronger imperative than anything else, because I believe in protecting the downside.
Yeah, that's a great way to put it, man.
Yeah. So like if there are, you know, I think the a well-known hedge fund that knows the space well passed along privately the information that 7 million people on the globe own $100 or more worth of Bitcoin.
Okay.
It's not very many people owning very much Bitcoin. We're going to try to create 21 million Bitcoiners that actually understand Bitcoin and give a shit and are stacking.
Love it, man. That's the goal, 21 million Bitcoiners.
21 million new Bitcoiners.
So, I mean, that's 3x what we currently have right now.
That's the goal.
Damn. I mean, I can't imagine, like, we've 7 million, you know, hodlers with a decent amount of skin in the game at this point has driven Bitcoin to, you know, $10,000 a coin. 3x that and the network effects that come with that. Meaning, you know, if you guys directly onboard 21 million Bitcoiners, the, you know, second, third order effects of that adoption is going to be, you know, 100 million Bitcoiners.
Yeah. Well, I think the only way that's going to happen is actually like essentially turning all Bitcoiners into a Bitcoin sales force.
Yeah.
You know, a marketing team for Bitcoin. And you don't, you know, word of mouth and people you care about is the way that, you know, most things are actually spread. You know, if I needed to buy a new laptop, the first thing I do is just like text my brother-in-law, because he's the nerd, right? He knows he's on Newegg every day, and like he'll tell me exactly what to buy. And, you know, I'll basically like whatever refurbished thing that he just got for cheap, I'll just buy the new version of that.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, so basically that's what we're doing, right? We want new coiners to learn about Bitcoin from people that actually care about them and want them to get involved in Bitcoin. And that goes both ways, by the way. So it's not just, you know, giving Bitcoin. It's also, let's say there's like a Gen Z or a millennial or someone that wants to get Bitcoin. They can put Bitcoin on their wish list and they can ask all of their, you know, rich relatives and friends or social followers or colleagues or whatever, and basically say like, I want Bitcoin for Christmas, birthday, graduation, bar mitzvah, wedding. And so it basically spreads both ways.
Nice. So a user could just give like a URL out for yes. the request for Bitcoin to their Give Bitcoin account?
That's right.
Okay.
That's right. That's and right. You can post that on social and you can, you know, promote that on your YouTube, and, you know, it's all individuals right now, but like very soon we'll have, you know, causes and institutions and yeah, all kinds of stuff.
That's rad, man. I love it. All right. Well, this is a good chance to like dive into the product a bit more. Can you walk us through the user experience on both ends, like the sender and the receiver?
Yeah, sure. So, let's say that there's a hypothetical person named Brady, and Brady has someone that he wants to become a Bitcoiner. Let's say that person's name is Neo. And so, Brady meets Neo and thinks that Neo has the makings of a good Bitcoiner because Neo's a human. And so Brady says, Hey, Neo, I'm going to send you some Bitcoin. And what's your email address? And you get Neo's email address, and this will be phone number 2 soon, just email to start. And you basically just like very quickly, it takes like less than 60 seconds to initiate the gift. You decide how much you want to give. Your choices of the time lock are 1 year, 5 years, or choose any date in between. So minimum 1 year, max 5 years.
Okay.
And Neo now gets an email that says, hey, you know, Brady gave you, you know, $21 worth of Bitcoin, you know, click here to claim it. And so basically then Neo goes and signs up for an account. This account is, and this is where it gets a little hairy, and this is, you know, this is definitely a trade-off where we want it fast and easy and we want the best chance of success. And the time lock is really important, and them actually owning the Bitcoin and you, you know, being able as the giver to essentially, if you want to be involved, you can, but if you don't want to be and you want to wash your hands of it and outsource, you know, Bitcoin IT support and education to us completely and never talk to that person again, you can. We do use a custodian. So mm-hmm. It is Prime Trust on the back end. The recipient opens an account you know, through us, essentially opens a user segregated account that holds their Bitcoin for them at Prime Trust. We never actually have any access to the account information, nor the obviously the actual currency on the dollar side of the transaction, nor the Bitcoin side. I should mention you can only liquidate dirty fiat for beautiful orange coin on our platform. You're not allowed to actually give away your own Bitcoins. You have to hold those. If you want to actually be part of our crew, you have to hodl all your Bitcoins. So then they open an account and accept the gift. And for larger gifts where you wouldn't want to, you know, get hit as the giver with like a, you know, what was that transaction again? So for larger gifts over $50, you have to accept within 30 days. If it's less than $50, then they actually have a full year to accept their gift, and we'll be, you know, prompting them and reminding them along the way that they have this gift waiting for them.
Right on. That makes sense.
And the nice thing is, you know, unlike, you know, like loading up a USB stick or something like that, and like actually having to put the Bitcoin on it and give it to them. Mm-hmm. And then either that Bitcoin is gone, or you've actually maintained ownership of that and are kind of like, you know, keeping a private key copy in the background just in case they lose it. The transaction never happens unless they are signed up for the platform. If they sign up for the platform, they are getting 12 account statements with what's going on with their Bitcoin value. And in every one of those account statements is another lesson from the Give Bitcoin curriculum. Right. So they're getting the 12 lessons. If your bank account is debited, they're getting the 12 lessons.
Cool. So what are those lessons like? I mean, who's developing it, and, you know, what topics are you going to be covering? And like, are you guys going to talk about shitcoins at all? Are you going to just focus completely on Bitcoin? Like, I mean, not talk about shitcoins in a good way, but like warn people about shitcoins, or just focusing on Bitcoin?
Yeah. So we are focusing 100% on Bitcoin. I wouldn't wish any of those other ones on people that I care about, like friends and family or other humans. Mm-hmm. So it's all Bitcoin. I feel like all of this effort that's been put into education over the last couple of years, and some of the good books that have come out, like Jan Pritzker's Inventing Bitcoin, and obviously Safe Dean's book, and the Rabbi's book, and some of the other ones, like they're all kind of coming toward a pretty good sense of like how to play it down the middle. And then it's all just kind of variations on that. So, you know, we're going to try really hard in that first one to hook somebody on Bitcoin and like try a few different analogies and different angles to like get them interested and start them down the rabbit hole. And hopefully they actually read ahead. So the whole curriculum will actually be available. They don't have to wait if they want to read ahead.
Okay.
And then, you know, module two will probably be more like, you know, what is money and, you know, what's wrong with our money? Like, why is it so bad? Why did we need this new money? And then three is going to be like a lot more about like Bitcoin network and like what it is as a hard currency and as a settlement layer and things like that. And so you can kind of imagine the natural progression. Mm-hmm. We'll get into some like some low time preference. We'll probably have one module that's just like, you know, kind of stories of people that came into Bitcoin and like how it changed their life, that kind of.
Nice. I like to hear that.
A little bit like the middle chapters of the Bitcoin standard, that kind of stuff. And then later chapters are going to be heavily influenced by, you know, people like Matt O'Dell, who's another advisor and part owner of the company, along with Safe Dean and Jan Pritzker and Stefan Lavera. So there'll be a lot more like technical stuff from like Stefan and Ragnar from Guns and Bitcoin and Matt in the later chapters, talking about, you know, cold storage and self-sovereignty and the importance of running a node and, you know, private transactions, things like that.
Nice.
And like what's in the future for Bitcoin. And then just kind of like, that's kind of how we're spacing it out.
Very cool. So let's say like, someone who's been gifted some Give Bitcoin, and they start going through the material and they're sold and they start getting into the, all right, what is this whole thing about sovereignty and holding my own keys and running a node, et cetera. At that point, I would assume that you know, that person might want to start like procuring some Bitcoin that they can hold, yeah, right? And it's not time.
Yeah, that's right.
Like, so, not time locked anymore.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So they'll have the option of buying right there through us.
Cool.
And they'll be able to time lock that if they want or not. So we actually have some people that want to. I think there's like a, we have the hashtag proof of HODL, which is basically like when somebody is like, you know what, I might have a little bit of a weak hand and I'm just going to time lock this.
Yeah. Yeah.
Not necessarily the greatest on self-sovereignty and key storage. And so I'd rather just leave this with Prime Trust, which also custodies Binance and Bittrex and Wobi and OKX and a bunch of funds and companies and OTC desks. Like it's a pretty good setup. But you know, our education and our whole bent is all about like what's good for Bitcoin, which is really all about, you know, self-custody and self-sovereignty. And so we're going to be educating about nodes, and I'm sure we'll develop partnerships with, you know, the cold cards and the costs of the world and
multi-chain
capitals for multi-sig and stuff like that. And really just like educate about what's out there and, you know, kind of go through the list of the Bitcoin only people that really have, you know, what's best for Bitcoin in mind with their product development and help promote those companies and encourage people to either do it direct where you can actually just buy and it goes straight into your Bitcoin address that you've preloaded, or we'll basically let you buy and then immediately sweep if you choose to.
Sure.
And we're going to heavily encourage, you know, DCA and try to get people to sign up for repeat purchases. Make that like literally the easiest, most feel good process that you could have to be stacking.
That's awesome. Are you guys buying your Bitcoin like daily or weekly? And then do you like actually, you have the automated process that then puts it into, like you said, it was a user defined account. So each person has like a separate account at Prime Trust.
That's right. Yeah. So initially it's batched daily. So all the orders, basically everyone who accepts on a given day,
yeah,
their givers accounts are then debited on that day. And the aggregate amount of that is purchased. This is all just kind of handled by a payment processor on the back end, but it's basically like smallish days are just bought on Kraken and largish days are Cumberland.
Yeah.
The OTC desk.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, the vision is pretty, pretty broad actually. Like this is sort of a, you know, I guess you would call it like a kind of an MVP that you're launching now. And it has just kind of the basic give Bitcoin functionality and time locking and et cetera. But the way that
it's a utility,
yeah,
you know, like it's a utility, like everything that Twitter has done over the last 12 years has basically just been like serving the needs of users that signed up for that initial utility to broadcast a message to anybody that followed you.
Yeah.
And this is similar. Like we see it as like, you know, a core function, but then you can expand and you end up naturally expanding into all of these other things to serve that user base.
Exactly.
You know, one thing I really wanted to touch on, which is, I think, you know, we've built this thing. We started coding July 1st and we're live now. So if you post this right away, it'll be at, for your users, beta.givebitcoin.io, but the main URL will have the full site, in the next couple of weeks after we sort of just like work out the final kinks, but everything's working and you're welcome to go and start banging around and trying it out.
It's exciting.
We develop really fast. I'm actually a partner, a part owner of the dev shop that is building it. So we get special access and do everything really quickly.
Nice.
We're building out a really robust affiliate program for referrals now. So I talked about how the main thrust of my career in startups the last half decade has been about trying to create these places to let 1,000 flowers bloom. And you don't know who's going to be the best at talking about Bitcoin and marketing Bitcoin. And maybe some kid at like, you know, Toledo University that just crushes it with his Bitcoin meetup and has dope presentations and leverages like some of our videos and passes out, you know, pamphlets that get everybody jazzed about Bitcoin. And we're going to be splitting our fees 50% with our referrers.
Nice.
That market and educate people about Bitcoin. And so we're doing the curriculum, but if this thing goes well and we, you know, have some revenue and are able to take in some investor dollars and like have the resources, basically what we want to do is we want to have like a really good repository of Bitcoin educational resources that anyone can use and then go and like turn on their community and their network to Bitcoin and then actually monetize their own evangelism through us and stack sats like nobody's ever stacked sats before.
That's amazing, man. So that's, I mean, I love that vision. You know, there's tons of examples of that model being super successful in retail and in other products. And I could, I could see, you know, like Hass McCook, Friar Hass, like building up some like huge Bitcoin church and evangelist in Australia.
He's going to have a congregation.
Start going door to door, right? Banging on doors, bringing the good Bitcoin word.
Dude, Satoshi's Witnesses is going to be a real thing down under.
Yeah, for real. I am more and more buying into this sort of analogy of Bitcoin and religion and, you know, secular religion, of course, but the similarities between the way religions have developed and the way Bitcoin is, you know, spreading are extremely similar. You just can't ignore it. I saw on your deck that you quoted one of Gigi's tweets about this. So you seem to be on board with it too, and you're using all kinds of religious terminology here. So what are your investors and stakeholders like? What do they think about this kind of what I would assume seems like a really far out idea to, you know, people who are in the mainstream and not in our little bubble?
Well, yeah. So, I mean, I obviously am like, that's how I see it. And I definitely am crazy evangelist, for better or worse. I think better. But that's powerful. That's powerful. So if you're, you know, I think what I talk about a lot is seeking 100% alignment with Bitcoin. And one of my actually like super smart friends out in New York actually knows randomly the gifting industry really well. And he made the point to me a few days ago that in the world of gifting, you don't market the gifting product, you market the gift.
Yeah.
And so basically all we need to do is talk about Bitcoin and like make as many people as we possibly can talk about Bitcoin and then give them away. You know, if they want to monetize through that, then they can. And the fact that they're going to be monetizing in sats, and, you know, I don't know about you, but like I have a weird mental accounting thing where like I just believe that Bitcoin is going up so much that, you know, whatever sats I earn, when I think about it in dollar terms, like I just automatically 10x it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like I'll jump through all kinds of like, I'll like sit there and like do stupid like sats earning things on my phone on one of these like janky new things out of Asia, but they actually like give you sats.
Yeah.
You know, for like clicking on, you know, which images have a streetlight.
Wait. I haven't heard about this.
I'll find it for you, dude. I'll find it for you. Yes. Brecky von Bitcoin and I have been wasting some time like earning like double and triple digit sats for tasks.
That's hilarious. It's
like, totally not. Like I'm earning like a penny for like 3 minutes or something. It's the dumbest use of time, but like I love earning sats.
Yeah, except in five years it'll look like a genius fucking spent, you know, three minutes, right?
Right. Maybe it'll look super smart. But I actually think that people would, rather than clicking on the streetlights in the pictures, being like a tap monkey, I think people would much rather evangelize Bitcoin and try to red pill Bitcoiners and be able to monetize that.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
So we're going to try to build that platform that lets people, you know, do what they naturally want to do anyway, which is talk about Bitcoin and try to get other people involved.
Cool. So who are your investors, if you can share?
So Tom Lee from Fundstrat is definitely cool with us mentioning him. Murad Makhmudov,
nice,
is an investor from Adaptive Capital, is a great analyst. I don't know if anybody else is actually comfortable with talking about them publicly, but we can definitely talk about the advisory board, which is obviously super important because those are the people that are actually developing the curriculum with us. So we're like interviewing our curriculum advisors, and that is what is becoming the curriculum. So Safety and Amos is an advisor and part owner of the company. Stefan Lavera, Matt O'Dell, Jan Pritzker, Meltem Demirors, Gary Leland from BitBlock Boom, Michael Karras, the Bitcoin rabbi, Ragnar Lithvisier from Guns and Bitcoin, Brecky von Bitcoin, obviously. Gotta have art represented. Did you see his new series where he's, and this is actually where we kind of want to go with this too. Like if we really can like take this platform, you know, we're right down the middle and have like one curriculum now, but we've always thought about, you know, you might pitch Bitcoin differently or talk about it differently to your 65-year-old grandma versus like a 13-year-old bar mitzvah kid.
Right.
So Brecky has a series out where he's saying like, you know, how do you pitch Bitcoin to a vegan? How do you pitch Bitcoin to a Buddhist? And yeah, absolutely. We want to have all that on there too.
Yeah, I love that. I love it.
We'll get there.
Yeah. So is that the series that he did for Tantor Labs?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah. All right. I'll have to link to it.
Great. Yeah, for sure. Yeah. So he's an advisor to us, and we'll probably sell some recce art on the site and stuff like that.
Sweet, sweet. Yeah. I love the Bitcoin art stuff. It's, you know, to, you know, when there's a movement, especially if it's, you know, you're getting into this kind of religious territory, art is super important, to, you know, making the case and, you know, memeing it into existence, as Bitstein would say.
Absolutely. Well, we like to say, give Bitcoin, number go up. Oh, and so one of Brecky's colleagues at Tantra is actually like the computer genius that does all their algos and stuff, is this guy Russell. And Russell's actually a yogi and like rocks the orange pants and everything.
Yeah.
So when we were all hanging out at a conference a few weeks back, he and Brecky came up with a mudra, which I guess is like, it looked like a gang sign to me, but you basically like, you put your hand out as if you're like giving or accepting a gift, and then you know, point up, like number go up. So it's kind of give Bitcoin, number go up. So now we're starting to throw up our gang sign mudra.
That's amazing. All our pictures. That's amazing. I love it.
You got a meme, man. Got a meme.
In all ways, shapes, and forms.
It shall be so. It was dictated from up on high by Bitstein Moses.
I love it. All right. Well, we've kind of touched on this a little bit, but I want to ask it in a way that I think might get us a little bit more out of it. You know, I think many Bitcoiners do that Bitcoin is inevitable, that really it's about this like economic truth of sound money that will assert itself one way or the other. So given that belief, you know, and I've had people push back on me on this front too. Like some people might say like, why is Bitcoin education something we should even care about? Because it's just going to happen anyway. So what do you have to say about that? Like, why is Bitcoin education important if we assume that Bitcoin is going to happen no matter what?
Because it's not like, do you want it to happen for you during your life and for your kids? Like, do I want my kids to grow up, you know, and hit their earning years in a time when it's much more fair and rational, and the marketplace that they go to work in is bigger and much more friction free and doesn't have all these friction tokens between each different country with their questionable governments printing money. Like I'd like to pull that future forward as much as possible.
For sure.
And that only happens through, you know, our disperse and collective efforts to educate and proselytize and bring about this future. Not to mention that, like, well, I don't think Bitcoin can be killed. I think it could certainly be hampered, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, if the U.S. government decides to make it illegal one day, well, even if there's some small chance of that happening, I want to make sure that it doesn't happen. So I want to protect that downside. So educating and getting it in the hands. I love what the rabbi did, getting Bitcoin money, you know, basically crowdfunding and getting people to buy 535 copies of the book and having them sent to the offices of every congressman and senator. Like, I would love to do that for 535 senators and reps and maybe a bunch more people too. And I think the gift cap is $50. Mm-hmm. So, you know, and their email addresses are public. So maybe I'll just do a little crowdfunding campaign and raise $25,000 and send $49 to each of their email addresses.
Yeah, imagine like getting Bitcoiners to do the same thing, you know, to their representatives and their constituencies. You know, like I could send $49 to my representative and both my senators. You know, that's a hundred.
Really good idea.
$147, but imagine, you know, you get like 100 of those or 200 of those in your office. You're not going to be able to ignore that.
Well, I think you just gave me a really good idea. Now I have to. I think you know Brian, our marketing guy, but I think what we need to do is I think we need to go state by state and we need to make it a year-long campaign.
Yeah.
And, you know, basically we'll do, you know, Iowa, you know, will be the first week of the year and we'll basically crowdfund and then disperse to their reps. Yeah. Maybe we'll go down to state senators and everybody and basically crowdfund the Iowa political class. And then the next week we'll do, you know, Oklahoma, and the next week it'll be Massachusetts.
I love it.
And basically just knock out like one state each week.
I love it.
But yeah, I think that like, it's just nice to have a mechanism through which that's possible.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
as you pointed out, like once the utility exists, then, and you basically build it like a platform that people can use a bunch of different ways, you know, they'll be creative about it. And we'll have some ideas, but I don't think we'll have the best ideas. I think other people will have much better ideas on how to spread Bitcoin than we will. We're just going to help make it possible.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and I think the other thing I think about it with Bitcoin education a lot is, besides just kind of speeding things up, is I think it's really important to help create a more peaceful transition, you know? Like, I think if we have a certain critical mass of education, like, you know, one, we'll create a political class that understands Bitcoin and, you know, is incentivized because they own some to, like, help create a world where Bitcoin is able to thrive. But two, like, if there's a certain number of people that just understand it in general, like, I think there's less likelihood that they're, like, some kind of government propaganda could, you know, create a situation where there's, you know, pro Bitcoiners and anti Bitcoiners, and there's just kind of a literally like physical violence that happens, you know, between people. But or just like state level violence to enforce bans and things like that. A lot of that I think would be much less likely to happen if we are like proactive about getting this message out there and educating, you know, very aggressively.
Yeah. I mean, you nailed it. I don't think I need to respond to that one.
Yeah, I know. It's just something that I think about quite a bit. But yeah, I think the reason I am extremely driven to educate about Bitcoin, obviously, and I think a lot of us are, but you know, that's one of the main motivations I see. One is exactly what you're saying. Like, I want this future to come for my kids, you know, sooner than later. You know, my daughter's 8 years old. She's going to be out on her own, you know, making her way and trying to figure out what she wants to do for a career and all that in just 10 years, which is not that far away. And so I feel like we have a ton of work in this critical next decade, you know, the second decade of Bitcoin's life, to really bring that, like you said, pull that future forward. I love that turn of phrase.
Yeah, I think that's right. Yeah, we're experimenting with, I think, you know, a tagline that I think we really want to push out, and don't steal it, guys, but actually in process of trademarking it, is own the future. Just started using that hashtag on Twitter, and I really like that idea of, like, you know, if this is going to be the future money, like, don't you want to own the future?
That's a good one, man.
And pull that future forward. So
yeah,
I think that makes a lot of sense.
So as we like start building out what I've been calling the Bitcoin education industry, because I see, you know, a lot of companies moving in that direction, I think it's going to be as we scale up, you know, like we said, 7 million Bitcoiners holding $100 or more worth of Bitcoin, like that's just tiny. So there's going to be, I mean, there's so many people to educate and bring up to speed on what we've been, you know, wandering around the rabbit hole for the last few years. So there's tons of work to do. Do you think that Bitcoin education will like more likely be sort of included as part of other Bitcoin services like Give Bitcoin or Cash App or Lolli? Or do you also like, do you foresee like dedicated education businesses, something like what Stefan's doing with Ministry of Nodes, or just both, I guess, developing simultaneously? Which one do you think makes more sense?
I think it's all kind of the same thing, I think. And it's like the same people are involved in all of it. Like, you know, like I'll obviously it's great to have Stefan's input on what we're doing, and, you know, have somebody that can read a module and tell us that section is stupid and you forgot this. Like, that's super crucial. And, you know, the work that he's doing with Ministry of Nodes, where, you know, he's learning exactly how to red pill Australians, often with hand-to-hand combat in seminars and, you know, meetups and stuff. Like, that's incredible primary research for someone like us that's trying to go, you know, a little bit more scaled. And then you've got, you know, obviously like what Safetyan is doing with his MOOCs. You know, he just quit academia and he's basically just teaching, you know, econ, Austrian economics, which is going to have like a healthy dose of Bitcoin in it. And, you know, I've got a few friends that I've watched a couple of the lectures, and I've got a couple of friends that have gone through all 10, and like, it's really good. And it's, you just can't really get that kind of attention. And I'm not talking about just like the video lectures, like you're getting a lot of access to him. You can email him anytime. He's got office hours where he like joins and you can talk to him by video conference. Like, he's really able to access his students in a way that he couldn't even when he was on campus.
Yeah.
So I think it's like super interesting that people are taking these different models. I love the effort that, you know, my brother from down under, Alex Svedsky with Amber, which has like a DCA app, dollar cost average app. He's got the Bitcoin Times. He just put out like a 36 page PDF that has like some really good angles on like intro to Bitcoin. Love that. I just think there's so much good stuff out there. Like our twist on it is like we are specifically targeting a new coiner that came into Bitcoin in this particular way. So it's very specific to our platform. And then we kind of like expand out from there. So, you know, it's actually written in a question and answer format. And the questions are the new coiner that just got their Bitcoin. And it's like, you know, why did they give me Bitcoin? What is Bitcoin? Like, and then we have an answer, you know, kind of reading it out. And we have like a really good voiceover actor to read the questions. And then naturally we have Guy from Cryptoconomy reading the answers.
Nice. The voice of Bitcoin.
Exactly. So that's the audio version of the
put out. Very cool. That makes sense. All right, man. I'm so excited about Give Bitcoin. I think this is going to be really fun to watch roll out and people get their hands on it. Finish up. I want to zoom out a little bit and talk, you know, a little bit more about just Bitcoin's future, sort of the situation that we're in right now. Maybe speculate a little bit about what's going to happen in the near term, and then maybe have some fun speculating more distant, just for a good time.
Mm-hmm.
What's your take on like the macroeconomic situation that we're in right now, and like how Bitcoin is going to respond, I guess, to it in the next few years?
Yeah, I mean, I think in absence of seeing Bitcoin in a financial crisis, and also kind of understanding where probably most of the money from Bitcoin has probably been coming for the last 5 years, it's hard for me to see that we are going to go up when the broad market goes down.
Yeah.
So, interestingly, I think probably the best thing for Bitcoin is a huge bull market from here, in U.S. equities in particular. So this is kind of like the Tom Lee. This is kind of like the Tom Lee viewpoint. Like Fundstrat is saying, like S&P goes to 18,000 over the next 10 years, and that we're actually like about to begin a crazy bull market. And you know, at least in nominal terms, it's hard to argue that that doesn't have a possibility. You know, I think the countervailing is like, you know, this thing can't go on forever. And, you know, this time isn't different. And we're building on a house of cards and we're just printing all this money. But like, you know, the ability of governments to keep printing money and keep things going has been well underestimated going back to 2012. Remember, this whole thing was supposed to unravel in 2012. And every year it's supposed to have unraveled. So I don't know. I do know that I think if there's a crash, that I think Bitcoin is still, you know, predominantly a risk on asset, and that I think a lot of people will pull money out of Bitcoin, at least initially, if there's a crash. You know, obviously my hope is that, you know, people pile back in, but I don't think that it's good for the Bitcoin price if there's an economic crash.
Yeah. I hadn't heard this Tom Lee take, because everything maybe I'm just in some kind of like doom and gloom economic bubble.
No, you're on the same Bitcoin Twitter that I'm on, and
right, yeah,
all we want to look at is like how effed up the financial system is,
right?
But remember, like an S&P that goes up that much is still nominally priced, it's not in real terms, and it goes along with like the world moving to negative interest rates everywhere. It goes along with, you know, essentially, I mean, most horrifying stats out there that I've seen recently is that 95% of the positive debt yield globally is US. So this then gets into like, you know, I think Nick Bhatia's piece either came out today or is about to come out this week, where he's basically going to explain, I think it's kind of just like the academic explanation of like what Trace always talks about with the different silos of, you know, of global assets, and that Bitcoin has to fill its silo. He basically is going to make this case that we're going to end up with like US treasuries, gold, and Bitcoin as being like the three assets that people try to hold and have exposure to, essentially thinking about as money or cash. Yeah. So that's probably where we're headed with Bitcoin. and, you know, the relative value of those and like how they trade, like we'll see. But, you know, treasuries do still have a positive yield, whereas dollars obviously still have a negative yield. But Nick's really, you know, strong, vociferous point, and I think he's right. I mean, guy's like a finance prof at USC, and he's been thinking about Bitcoin nonstop for 6 years, so he's probably right, is that we shouldn't be thinking about Bitcoin competing with the US dollar. It's actually much more like US treasuries, and that's really what has the target on its back for Bitcoin is treasuries.
Yeah, that makes sense. So how long do you think this battle will play out between Bitcoin and the Fed?
So again, that's the Treasury Department, not the Fed, because the Fed prints the dollars, and the dollars will, in fact, inflate significantly against Bitcoin over time.
Okay, gotcha.
The treasuries, which is like the power of the U.S. consumer and all of our entrepreneurship and our like massive geographic and demographic advantages over every other country on the planet, and the U.S. military sort of securing the future. Like, you know, I very much subscribe to the, you know, Stratfor, George Friedman, you know, Peter Zion view of things that, you know, the 21st century is actually the American century. The 20th century was just a preview. So I actually think that U.S. extends its power and, you know, becomes further entrenched as the one economy and, you know, global political power that actually matters. We're not heading for a multipolar world. We're not heading for splintering. This is like the century of American dominance, and even the rise of Bitcoin. I think that happens alongside of it, and that our best bet for securing the future of Bitcoin is actually getting people to see it as like the most American, most patriotic, most sort of like, you know, literally aligned with the views of the founding fathers. You know, taking all the energy from like Ron Paul's 1992 presidential run and making that go wide and making it Bitcoin instead of gold.
Yeah, that's amazing. So you think we'll be able to then shift back to some kind of a Bitcoin standard then in the future in America and I guess globally?
Well, again, this is where I think that Trace and Nick probably have it right. You can have a Bitcoin standard as long as people are able to price things in Bitcoin.
Yeah.
That's all that's really required. So there were still plenty of other currencies being used all around the world on the gold standard during, you know, the Industrial Revolution, Belle Epoque, you know, late 18th century, whatever. There were still local currencies, but there was also a gold price and everybody kind of knew what it would cost in gold as well, mm-hmm. or in, you know, Bank of England banknotes. So I think that will probably accelerate a lot faster than people think. Like we're probably like 15 years away from most people around the world using Bitcoin as a unit of account. And that's because it's going to be easier to use Bitcoin as a unit of account than it is going to be using gold or treasuries. So those are going to be the three big assets. Mm-hmm. And you should have Nick on because I haven't even read it and I've talked to the guy twice and I don't understand 1/1000th of what he does about this stuff, but it just makes sense because, you know, Trace has been talking about this for so long about these asset silos and that we just need to fill the grain silo that is Bitcoin, but it doesn't mean the other silos go away.
Right. Okay. That makes sense.
And then the other thing that's, you know, the other thing that's kind of dovetailing with all of this for me is, you know, SAFE's new area of research and just starting to kind of lay out his thinking about, that we might just de-dollarize instead of hyperinflate the dollar, and that's probably a much more likely income and a much more likely outcome is that we actually, as demand for dollars gets siphoned off by Bitcoin, they're not going to supply the same amount of dollars. They'll cut the supply because they only supply dollars based on the demand. That's actually how the Fed works anyway. Like the Fed, people don't really realize like so the Fed doesn't actually like set rates to dictate what banks do. The Fed sets rates in response to the requests for loans from their member banks. So the Fed is owned by the banks, right? It's a private company. That's a consortium of, you know, the big banks basically own the Fed. And if the banks have a bunch of demand for loans from businesses, then they go to the Fed and say, we need more money to lend out. And then the Fed goes and basically like creates the money to supply those loans. If there's no demand for the loans, they won't create the dollars. So when people don't want dollars for their business and they prefer Bitcoin, the Fed's not going to create money. So if you reduce supply and demand, you know, we have a good chance at, you know, not hyperinflating and having much more of like a soft landing for the dollar where it's still around, but there's a lot less of them.
Yeah. Yeah, that makes sense. And yeah, that I have heard Safe sort of teasing that idea out a bit. And it's encouraging to imagine that and like not having, I think a lot of Bitcoiners have assumed in the past, like some sort of major battle, monetary battle, money battle, play out. But it's just like people saying, yeah, the demand, the market demand is like, we want Bitcoin, we want to get paid in Bitcoin. So, okay, we'll start paying you in Bitcoin. And then it's, you know, just kind of inevitable from there that people start pricing services and goods in Bitcoin. And then, yeah, you just kind of phase out the dollar over time. It makes sense.
Yeah.
So, all right, just for fun, I'm sure you've daydreamed about this at least a little bit. What do you think a Bitcoin future looks like in the more distant future, like 50 years from now?
There'll probably be a lot of, you know, salvage crews going out into the lakes and the oceans trying to find all of this boating accident Bitcoin that they read about on Twitter, in the Twitter archives. So it'd be like, wow, like that guy talked about Bitcoin a lot. I bet, you know, he lived in Ohio in 2018 when he had his boating accident. There's only so many lakes in Ohio. And then, you know, Bitcoin boating accident treasure hunts will be like a huge growth industry. You know, mine is actually all, you know, somewhere at the bottom of the marina here in Los Angeles. So,
yeah, I mean, I lost mine out at Clinton Lake. I was just getting pulled on one of those, one of those like tubes, you know, the inner tubes getting pulled and just like, I don't know what, had my ledger with me. I don't know.
Bitcoins fell right out of your pocket.
This is crazy.
They sunk.
Yeah. So figure out how to get the Bitcoin 50 years from now off a waterlogged treasure.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. I mean, I hope that 50 years from now that this, so I think maybe like the most analogous future for us as we decentralize a bit and head more toward, you know, like one great commercial union where Bitcoin is the language by which we coordinate activity and essentially talk to each other around the world and get rid of all these friction tokens and get rid of like, you know, using money as a weapon, which, you know, money is totally weaponized around the world, you know, maybe primarily by the US, but indeed by many other countries as well. And if you can kind of get rid of that, I think what you may have is like a global version of the most successful empire that ever existed, which isn't written about very much, but, you know, the Phoenician Empire was around for a couple thousand years. And most of what we consider, you know, fantastic traditional culture was from the Eastern Mediterranean. This is, you know, this is where Nassim Taleb, my my favorite philosopher is from Lebanon, Seyfedin, Palestinian. I don't think it's any coincidence that they come from that tradition. You know, the land of Ruby, all these great Mediterranean towns there, traditionally. And, you know, that was just a commercial empire and they didn't fight wars and they were traders and they had, you know, immense wealth, great knowledge, and developed societies that have lasted 5,000 years on the backs of those traditions. And so I could see this just being like this global, great marketplace that, you know, lifts all boats, that undoes what we've seen since 1971, where, you know, basically that's the great chart where from the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, productivity has risen, you know, 2% every year, and wages did too up until 71, and then they flatlined and the lines totally diverged. Well, now we'll be able to get back and, you know, essentially let people earn their fair share of the productivity gains. I'm like super hopeful. And you know, I think, you know, Bitcoin will keep what happens with treasuries, you know, in check, and with the dollar in check, and with the euro in check, and what happens with Zimbabwean dollars and everything else. Like just having that available, you know, that you can keep your money in your head and you can exit without physically having to exit, and just the check that provides, you know, it only needs to reach a certain size. I don't know what it is, but it's probably like even if it's like matches gold, that's probably enough to like end most tyranny.
Yeah, yeah.
Like that doesn't, you don't need, you probably need like $7 trillion worth of Bitcoin to stop tyranny from happening. And if you can like three.
Yeah, disincentivize.
Something basically. That people can own. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And you know, tyranny. Most yeah. tyranny is enabled by the printing of money and
right.
capital controls, right? Like it's the first thing that happens. Argentina yep. goes crazy and capital controls out of nowhere. And Hong Kong shuts down withdrawals from the ATMs. Like if you can't do that anymore because we're good with mesh networks and we're good with VPNs and we have, you know, Tor 2.0 and, you know, Bitcoin wallets are super easy and, you know, they're easy to hide and, you know, everything just gets like better from a UX standpoint. It's just super easy to hold Bitcoin and transact in Bitcoin. You just won't have this chicanery, or as my father-in-law would say, this tomfoolery.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
From these governments anymore. They just won't be able to get away with it.
Yeah. 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 I think Give Bitcoin is going to be a big part of, you know, bringing the masses around to that potential future. You know, there's definitely some education to happen and knowing how to take control of your privacy and the reasons why you want to take control of your privacy and route around these kind of centralized modes of information sharing that we've sort of built up. You know, the original vision of the internet was to create this decentralized network that would be resistant to black swan events. And we've largely sort of, you know, been gradually centralizing since kind of those early days of you know, with the decentralized sort of ethos of the internet. And we have these massive data silos now, and it's turned into sort of a way for governments to spy on and corporations to spy on people and track people. And you know, Bitcoin is incentivizing this future of kind of returning to that decentralization and enabling the tools that we need. Like you mentioned, mesh networks and Tor 2.0 and all that stuff is just part of the Bitcoin infrastructure. And yeah, that's, I think, given me a ton of hope to think about a future like that where, you know, as opposed to continuing on the path that we've been on, and you know, no one wants to live in that kind of an oppressive society. You know, it's just not a hopeful place to be. So
I think you're right. Yeah, you're definitely right. And, you know, I think, I think some of the stuff that, you know, Giacomo, Zuko, and Luke Dash Jr., the things that they talk about ensuring that like a preponderance of Bitcoiners really go full Bitcoin citizen. You know, that weighs heavily on my mind, you know, creating a, what is initially a custodial service, or kind of has to be for the product, 100% has to be for the product to function with double opt-in yep. gifting and the time lock and set it and forget it and all that. But it's incumbent upon us to, you know, truly educate people about, you know, self-sovereignty and make sure that, you know, the majority of these people start stacking and taking it into, you know, their own custody over time, because that is what really inoculates Bitcoin from a future much like the internet, right? Where it used to be all about permissionless, and because we were just kind of lazy and government turned a blind eye to most of what was going on, we got lazy and we let it centralize, and then the government came in and said, oh, well, now that you're centralized, well, we need that backdoor. And so that really is the risk to Bitcoin as well. And this was, you know, option three, I think I heard Giacomo running through this on a recent podcast, and it totally, you know, gave me pause. And, you know, I've already been thinking about this, but it's made me even more sort of mission driven to make sure that, you know, everyone that comes into Bitcoin through us understands that, you know, if you're capable in the least, you're not like indigent 95 or, you know, 12 years old or something, like, you know, take custody of your Bitcoins and be a full Bitcoiner.
Yeah, and it's not that hard anymore with services like Unchained and Casa. Mm-hmm. It's really, really simple, and the UI UX is just getting better and better. And you know, you have great support teams at both companies that are there to help you if you have any questions whatsoever.
I'm an advisor to Unchained, and love those guys. Yeah. Let's see how sponsorship goes. Maybe I'll get a little bee in their bonnet about this. You can get number two. But yeah, I think that's, so that, that is the risk, right? Like if most people just think about Bitcoin as being something that sits in their account at, you know, at their bank, and the government lets that happen for 20 or 30 years. And, you know, if today, you know, maybe whatever it is, the estimates are anywhere from 2 to 7 million Bitcoins are custodied in some way today. You know, if that creeps up and it ends up being like 70 or 80 or something like that over time, and then the government decides, yeah, you know what, we're just going to go, you know, or hamper it in some way, or at least, you know, come in and get all the info and kind of know who all the Bitcoiners are and whatever.
Yeah. You know, that, which happened with gold, right? I mean, FDR did it in the beginning of World War One.
33. Yeah.
World War II,
confiscated it all.
Yeah.
So yeah, I think it's super important, or not confiscated, but like forced the sale of, I should say. But yeah, so I think it's very important that we think about the things that are, you know, have a 1% chance of happening if it would obliterate the whole thing, or a 10% chance of happening, and really think about inoculating ourselves against that. And that's why we're, you know, really focused on getting lots more Bitcoiners, getting the political and the financial class of the United States in particular to understand Bitcoin and hold a lot and care. And be ready to take the opposing argument when the Brad Shermans of the world come for your Bitcoin. And we just need to make sure that there's a lot of Senator Warrens and crappos out there to argue the counterpoint, and to be able to stand there, you know, armed and ready with a lot of great memes and a lot of great arguments and a lot of constituents, you know, prompting them to push forward on their pro-Bitcoin agenda.
Yep, absolutely, man. Absolutely. I think we can just mic drop it right there. I think that's perfect way to end it. Really, thank you so much for coming on. This was a ton of fun. I will certainly be cheering on and using Give Bitcoin. I think it's a great idea and mission, and I hope and think it will become a tremendous success, man.
Yeah, we hope so too, man. We're just, we love slanging that Bitcoin, man. We just want to sell a lot of it.
Hell yeah. Get it out there, man.
Give education. Bitcoin, number go up.
That's right. Give Bitcoin, number go up. We can all be on board with that, I would think.
Awesome.
All right, man. Thanks again. Take care, dude.
Thanks, Brady.
All right. Thanks again to Corey for joining me today. So what do you all think about Give Bitcoin? What do you all think about the conversation we just had? Lots of great stuff raised, especially toward the end there, about Bitcoin's prospects, about the macroeconomic situation, how things are going to play out. Let us know your thoughts about any and all of those things on Bitcoin Twitter. Corey is at Corey Klipsten, at CoryKlipsten. Give Bitcoin is at give_Bitcoin. And I, of course, am at Citizen Bitcoin. You can support the podcast by sharing it out on Bitcoin Twitter or share it with your family and friends. In fact, you know, send them some Bitcoin and Bitcoin education with Give Bitcoin, and then tell them to subscribe to the Citizen Bitcoin podcast, and we'll help you turn them into wizened toddlers. All right, before I go, my open source shout out for this week is Zap. Jack Mahler's Lightning Wallet project has evolved into one of the most important Bitcoin open source projects. Just yesterday, the Zap project hit 1,000 stars on GitHub. They've built an incredible open source community around this project. Zap is now available on iOS, Android, Linux, macOS, and Windows. Just connect to your LND node to get started. You can support the project by joining the Zap GitHub and Slack to help test beta releases, request features, provide feedback, and of course, coding. So, yeah, that's it for this one. Take care out there, Bitcoiners, wherever you happen to be in the world.